Jems, I just got back from a difficult trip to Utah. I'm going to have an honest moment with you. I hope it's okay. Personal moment. But 20 months ago, my baby brother was severely injured in a tragic accident. Many of you do know this. You know what happened. My brother Jamies, though, I call him Jamie, that's his nickname. His name is Jameis. And he and I were very close, very. I was 7 years older than him, or M. 7 years older than him. And he was remarkable, kind, brilliant, humble, creative, the whole everything. He was also just so supportive of me. And just before his accident, he was featured in the New York Times and Rolling Stone magazine. I am such a proud big sister. I'll actually have links to those articles in the description of this episode or video, whether you're watching on our podcast or YouTube. I guess, why am I saying this? I think I'll get to the point here. Jamie lived more life in 35 years than most do in 80, and I admired him for that. And he was so supportive. He actually told me that he wanted to invest in hidden true crime. And I accepted, and we talked about what we were going to do. And what we planned to do was actually a news type of a program or headlines. The latest in many cases, HTC covers. Of course, we never got there. Jameis's brain never recovered like we had hoped and hasn't the last 20 months since that terrible crash. Jameis is still with us. I want to make that clear. But I also want to make it clear that I did say some goodbyes this weekend. I am heartbroken. And so, in his honor, I wanted to try something that Jamie and I never got to do, which is bringing headlines to you, our hidden gems. And I would like to start with Delphi, a major update in justice for Abby Williams and Libby German, and also because I am headed to Delphi, Indiana tonight. Back in November, after the lengthy trial that I attended with 18 days of testimony, 64 witnesses, and nearly 400 exhibits, Richard Allen was convicted of killing 14-year-old Liberty German and 13-year-old Abby Williams, best friends. And this week, Richard Allen returns to court just before Christmas for a sentencing on Friday, December 20th. The sentencing is scheduled from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., although we don't know how long it's actually going to go. And once again, there will be no cameras or any electronics of any kind in the courtroom, not even my Apple Watch here. And during that time, we are expected to hear from the victim's family members, possibly members of the Allen family, I'm unsure. And we will also most likely hear from both the defense and prosecution. I do hope to be in the courtroom, and I am hours away from getting on a flight. So stick with me, and I will bring you the very latest from Indiana and major updates in another case that we've been following, the Rex Huerman case. On Tuesday, Rex, often referred to as the Long Island serial killer or the Gilgo Beach serial killer, was officially charged with a seventh murder. A quick recap for those of you who aren't familiar with this case, and I will do that so that we can all get caught up in all of these cases so that come 2025, you guys will all be updated. Back in 2010, a woman named Shannon Gilbert went missing in Long Island, New York. And as they were searching for her, human remains for 10 different people, including one toddler, were found. Now, some of the victims matched other remains that were found years before. And so this was like finding the rest of their remains in this area. And they were uncovered during the search, 10 different sets of remains. And however, despite this grisly discovery, no one knew how all of these people, mostly female sex workers, ended up in this same area. There were connections made between the murders, but who did it? And why they did it remained a mystery until, that is, July 2023, when Rex Huerman was arrested and charged with the murder of three of the 10 victims. Their names were Melissa Bartholomew, Megan Waterman, and Amber Costello. And 6 months later, Huerman was charged with a fourth murder, the murder of Maureen Brainard Barnes. And this past June, he was charged with two more murders: Sandra Costilla, whose body was found back in the 90s, and Jessica Taylor, whose skull was found back in 2003, and more remains were found of Jessica in 2011. So then this Tuesday, Rex was officially charged with the murder of Valerie Mack.
As we all know by now, today my office filed a superseding indictment charging the defendant Yerman with a seventh charged murder in the second degree for the murder of Valerie Mack, which occurred in 2000. I remind everyone that all of these cases and all of these murders are just allegations, and we look forward to proving them in court. As I've previously stated, the work of the Gilgo Task Force is ongoing and continuing. And when I said that, I meant what I said. The defendant is now charged with the murder of seven young women, Sandra Castillo from 1993, Valerie Mack from 2000, Jessica Taylor from 2003, Maureen Brainerd Barnes from 2007, Melissa Bartholomew from 2009, Megan Waterman from 2010 in June, and Amber Costello from September of 2010. Again, they occurred between 1993 and 2010. We are here because the Gilgo Task Force has continued to work together to obtain not only evidence for the charged crimes, but has continued to work on other uncharged crimes as well. And I am grateful for the great work that the Gilgo Task Force has done. Of course, not only my office and my team, but the other agencies who have worked with us, and we're gonna talk about that in a while. As you've also probably noticed, we here with us today are the victims' family members. I think pretty much every charged victim, their family members are here. Specifically, we're joined by Joanne and Edwin Mack, who are the parents of Valerie Mack. Through the grand jury process, we get to learn a little bit about our victims, and we did that through the Mack family. Valerie is very similar to the other victims in this case, extraordinary person. The family are extraordinary people, and we are honored to prosecute this case for Valerie and her family, or on behalf of Valerie and her family. I think the Mack family is emblematic of the other families in this case who have steadfastly stood by their loved ones and jealously guarded their memories. And, we have nothing but respect and admiration for those victims' families.
Now, Valerie first went missing back in 2000 when she was just 24 years old. Part of her remains were found later that year by three hunters, and then her skull and right foot were found in 2011. And although it took until 2020 for law enforcement to identify her, it's very clear that Valerie's murder was extremely brutal. Both of her hands were severed, her right leg was cut off, and her torso, arm, and legs were all tied with rope. Authorities say Rex was linked to the murder based on a female hair linked to his wife and daughter that was found on Valerie's body. And aside from the DNA on the hair, authorities discussed the other evidence they had during this press conference. Take a listen.
We've placed some other evidence with regard to the planning document, specifically, if you recall, the HK document, which we've referred to as the planning document. We see that one of the dump sites which were discussed in that document was Mill Road, which was the road that Valerie was found in the vicinity of. We also have seen during our searches a number of articles with regard to the Gilgo Beach investigation in various publications like People. There was a New York Times Magazine article about the Gilgo investigation, which was found in the defendant's safe, as well as other news articles in which the discovery of the bodies of Sandra, Jessica, and Valerie are found. And those newspapers were retained by the defendant, as well as information when Valerie was identified, when she was positive, when she went from being, I believe she was Jane Doe number 6, and then through the work of the FBI, we were able to establish that it was Valerie, that the body was Valerie's, that there was internet searches done from devices controlled by the defendant at or around the time that she was first identified. That's the evidence in this case. Again, it's just that. It's evidence, it's allegations, and we look forward to proving them at court.
Now, they did allow questions at the end of the press conference, and they shared even more about the evidence against Rex.
Suri, a bail application, the evidence and the allegations you mentioned, things that are found either in the home or his office. I wasn't sure if that was the Manhattan office, but you talked also about the newspaper articles. There was evidence of a plumber being called to the home. Could you go over it?
Yeah, so, if you look at the planning document, it's discussed the foaming cleaner issues with regard to that. And at around the time of the commission of this crime, there was plumber did go to the Uhrman residence.
So you're thinking that some of the murders could have taken place in the home?
Well, I mean, obviously we don't have to specifically prove where they happened. We have other elements that we need to prove. But I think if you look at this case, if you look at the planning document, if you look at the adhesive staining on the walls in a sort of enclosed pattern, certainly all of that is consistent with the commission of those murders occurring at the home.
The attorney, Peach's toddler daughter, was down very close on Mission Parkway to Valerie Mack. Would that lead you to believe that Rex Uhrman could be responsible for the murder of the toddler and Peaches?
Doesn't matter what I believe, as I say, matters what I can prove. And, what we've done, and to the extent we've been able to have success, is you take each one of these cases, you take each one of the location of the bodies, and you use that as a separate investigation in a separate crime scene until you're specifically given clues which allow you to put them together. So until we're able to do that, we won't speak on that, and we speak through indictments.
Well, quick follow-up. When Rex Uhrman loudly proclaimed in court that he's not guilty of any of these charges, just your thought.
Listen, that's the process, and right now, he's absolutely right. These are allegations, and it's our obligation to prove them. So we're going to be held to our burden. We're going to be held to our task, and we look forward to doing that.
Valerie's leg being cut off is in line with a planning document found on Rex's computer that Rex allegedly made, which could also be referred to as basically a how to get away with murder guide. In that, he talked about removing tattoos, which he considered ID marks. Valerie had a tattoo of her son's name on her right leg. Rex appeared in court on Tuesday, where he told the judge, quote, "Your Honor, I am not guilty of any of these charges," end quote. Rex's attorney plans to argue that the fifth and sixth murders he was charged with for Sandra Castilla and Jessica Taylor should be tried separately. And now it looks like he's going to do the same arguing when it comes to the seventh murder he's been charged with. We also know that his attorney is going to be trying to get a change of venue, as he believes the media coverage in this case severely hinders the ability to have a fair trial. And in his words, the only place to have a fair trial would be Mars, because the jury pool has been poisoned. So to get caught up on this case, if you want more on this case, you can check out our full Gilgo Beach playlist or our full Gilgo Beach podcast season. And now on to Corey Richens. Last Thursday, December 12th, Corey Richens appeared in court for a pre-trial hearing in regards to her upcoming trial that is scheduled to begin in April. Now, if you need a deep dive on this case, our full backstory is also linked in the description of this episode. And that's what I always do, by the way. Anything we bring up that you feel is important, always check the description of our videos or our podcast episodes to find what we are discussing. But for a quick overview, in March 2022, Eric Richens died under suspicious circumstances after allegedly drinking a Moscow Mule prepared by his wife, Corey Richens, in bed, because Corey claimed he was celebrating the purchase, or they were celebrating, I should say, the purchase of a new investment property that Corey had made. And when his death was investigated, it was found that he had 5 times the lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. And after his death, Corey finalized the sale on this $2 million investment property, released a children's book on grief, and sued Eric's sister over the trust, all before she was arrested and charged with his murder 14 months later. As the case progressed, Corey racked up 11 charges in total, which were, are you ready for this? Felony, aggravated murder, attempted criminal homicide, 2 counts of distribution of a controlled substance, 2 counts of mortgage fraud, 2 counts of fraudulent insurance claim, and 3 counts of forgery. That's quite the list. Over time, in the months following her arrest, we learned more details in the case, including the fact that Corey had been allegedly trying to get rid of Eric for quite some time. Just a couple of weeks before his death, he had reached out to friends saying he thought Corey was trying to poison him. That's not a red flag. And this was after he had eaten a sandwich on Valentine's Day that prosecutors say was laced. Not only that, but police received a tip from an informant who turned out to be a dealer who claimed they had sold fentanyl to Corey before Eric died. And then to top it off, it was discovered that Corey was in serious financial distress at the time of Eric's death. She had a number, or I should say a negative number. She had a negative number in her bank account, owing more than $1.8 million and was being sued by a creditor. She also had purchased multiple life insurance policies on Eric. It is alleged that due to their prenuptial agreement, she believed that she would inherit his trust. However, she had no idea that Eric had, well, made his sister the trustee on his estate. And of course, let's also throw in that Corey was having an affair with the handyman. So Corey ended up pleading not guilty to all 11 charges. And then just last month, the 2 counts of distribution of a controlled substance were dropped. It was also decided she would be tried separately on 2 of the 3 counts of forgery and the 2 mortgage fraud charges stemming from things that happened before Eric died. So in other words, that will be a completely different trial, not this one that's about to come up and that I'm about to tell you. But well, last week, when Corey appeared in court for another pretrial hearing, the scheduled 2025 trial was lengthened an extra week after both the prosecution and the defense were worried about not having enough time to argue their case. Corey's team let the court know that they plan to have quite the defense prepared for her, which possibly, get this, includes Corey testifying at her own murder trial. They said that if Corey testifies, it will be lengthy. That was the word they used, lengthy. They also dealt with issues regarding jury selection. Both sides wanted jurors from both Summit County, where the crime occurred, as well as Salt Lake County, a neighboring county in Utah. However, the judge has currently ruled that they will not be able to call jurors from Salt Lake. Corey's attorney has said, though, that they plan to appeal that decision. Corey returns to court on January 23rd, 2025, for another pretrial hearing where they will decide what evidence will be allowed in during her trial that is scheduled for April 21st, 2025. That's the plan right now. I was actually just recently in Midway, Utah, and checked out Corey's investment property, the one that she was allegedly celebrating with her husband, Eric, the night he died. Well, you can find that video on our YouTube channel, Hidden True Crime, if you want to see that. It's 2 kitchens, 12 bathrooms. It's massive. And now let's get to a very recent case that we have been following very closely from the very beginning, and that is Luigi Mangione. There has been no shortage of updates in the Luigi Mangione case. And most recently, he was formally indicted in the New York Supreme Court this week. According to court documents, he is charged with the following: 1 count of murder in the first degree. That changed, by the way. Remember, what the original charge was, second degree. So here we go. 1 count of murder in the first degree in furtherance of terrorism. 2 counts of murder in the second degree. One is charged as killing as an act of terrorism. 2 counts of second degree criminal possession of a weapon. 4 counts of third degree criminal possession of a weapon. 1 count of fourth degree criminal possession of a weapon, and 1 count of second degree criminal possession of a forged instrument. There was a press conference to announce the indictment and give more details on the charges and what they mean. Take a listen.
Let me tell you a bit about the facts. On November 24th, we allege that the defendant arrived in New York City to murder Brian Thompson. After the defendant arrived in New York City on a bus at Port Authority, he checked into the hostel on the Upper West Side using the name Mark Rosario with a fake New Jersey ID. On the morning of December 4th, the defendant left the hostel, just after 5:30 a.m. and traveled to Midtown. For nearly an hour, we allege the defendant waited in the area near the Hilton Hotel, waiting for Mr. Thompson to appear. From 6:38 a.m. to 6:44 a.m., the defendant stood across from the entrance of the hotel on West 54th Street. When he saw Mr. Thompson, he crossed the street and approached him from behind. We allege he then took out a 9mm 3D printed ghost gun, equipped with a 3D printed suppressor, and shot him once in the back and once in the leg. The defendant then fled northeast on 54th Street and took an e-bike uptown before getting into a taxi that took him to West 178th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. On December 9th, the defendant was spotted at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania. The local police were notified, he was arrested, and he was found with a 9mm handgun, a suppressor, two ammunition magazines, and the same fake New Jersey ID he used at the hostel. I want to say a word about ghost guns. These weapons are increasingly proliferating throughout New York City and the entire country. Involving technology will only make this problem worse. Last year, over 80 ghost guns and ghost gun parts were recovered in Manhattan alone. The NYPD and the Manhattan DA's office have been leading in the interdiction of these ghost guns. And one thing I want to make clear, they are unserialized. They can be printed out. But as this case tragically makes clear, they are just as deadly as traditional firearms. This will remain a priority for us here in Manhattan.
Well, during the press conference, the NYPD commissioner brought up the social media uproar that has been circulating since the arrest of Luigi. And if you know about this case, you probably know about how much people are talking about this on social media, not just social media, but also the media. Take a listen.
In the nearly 2 weeks since Mr. Thompson's killing, we have seen a shocking and appalling celebration of cold-blooded murder. Social media has erupted with praise for this cowardly attack. People ghoulishly plastered posters threatening the CEOs, other CEOs, with an X over Mr. Thompson's picture, as though he was some sort of a sick trophy. And yesterday, the New York Post reported that some extreme activists were circulating a deck of cards with other most wanted CEOs to be targeted for assassination. These are the threats of a lawless, violent mob who would trade in their own vigilantism for the rule of law that protects us all. Let me say this plainly. There is no heroism in what Mangione did. This was a senseless act of violence. It was a cold and calculated crime that stole a life and put New Yorkers at risk. We don't celebrate murders and we don't lionize the killing of anyone. And any attempt to rationalize this is vile, reckless, and offensive to our deeply held principles of justice.
What's one financial lesson you learned the hard way? I'll go first. For me, it's not too late to start saving. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. You do not need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that matches you and your money goals. You don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you get started with just the spare money you have right now. And one of the best things about Acorns is they allow you to see projected growth on their website. Simply go online, type in how much money you would like to put in, and see the potential future balance of your account. Sign up now and join over 13 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $22 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/hiddentruecrime. Hormonal changes are so hard, to say the least. Hot flashes, anyone else? Add in the thousands of hormone disruptors that are in our environment, and it is even worse. From our water, food, the air we breathe, and the clothes we wear, they are everywhere. But the good news is that when Hormone Harmony enters the picture, it can help reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. Hormone Harmony is a supplement that contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. The best thing about adaptogens, they help the body adapt to any stressors like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony is actually part of my personal 2024 playbook. Hormone Harmony makes no compromises when it comes to quality, and it shows. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. That's happy, H-A-P-P-Y, mammoth, M-A-M-M-O-T-H.com. Just use the code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's code HiddenTrueCrime. Use that with happymammoth.com for 15% off today. Every year, I make the eat healthier, workout, be healthier resolution. But every year, it's hard to stick with it. If I had an automatic way to do those things, it might happen. It would be a breeze. Similarly, every year, thousands of people add saving money and investing money to their New Year's resolutions. And Acorns makes it easier to start saving and investing automatically. You don't need to be rich or have to go on some crazy budget that doesn't allow you any freedom. With Acorns, you can start with $5 or even just some spare change. Acorns shows you where your money's going and you see projected growth. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing in your future today. Paid non-client endorsement compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/hiddentruecrime. We have all seen the media uproar, and it has made us question, does publicity impact the legal process of a case? As we were researching this case, we learned that a Florida woman was arrested after threatening Blue Cross and Blue Shield after they denied her claim. A 42-year-old woman named Brianna Boston was on the phone with the insurance company and was upset about the denial of her claims. Well, toward the end of the call, she told the representative on the phone, quote, delay, deny, depose. You people are next, end quote. Well, she has now been charged with threats to conduct a mass shooting or act of terrorism. When police talked with Brianna, she apologized and told them that the reason she had used those words is because it's been in the news lately, which is true, kind of. The bullets Luigi had similar words, deny, defend, and depose. I think that's what Brianna probably meant to say, but it makes me question, I've been talking about this with Dr. John, does significant media coverage cause copycat crimes? Does it make things worse? And thankfully, though, Brianna never did do anything. And shifting back to Luigi for a bit, something interesting. Luigi's grandma actually left millions for her family members, an inheritance, around 30 million to be exact. But wait for this. She has one condition, and that is no grandchild receiving an inheritance could be, quote, charged, indicted, convicted of, or plead guilty to any felony. End quote. So it looks like Luigi won't just be denied insurance, but actually his possible family's inheritance. Very interesting. We have also learned that Luigi's mother told investigators that based on the photos she was shown of Luigi, she couldn't be sure it was him, but that the shooting, quote, might be something she could see him doing, end quote. This conversation happened after a police sergeant in San Francisco who was handling the missing persons report filed by Luigi's mom in November called the FBI and told them that the photo seemed to resemble Luigi. Attorney Bragg also discussed that Luigi's intent was to show terror, hence the terrorism charges. And Dr. John, my co-host, has said the same thing about terror. And if you want an in-depth look on the hidden motives of Luigi Mangione, from a forensic or criminal psychologist, check out our last two episodes on YouTube or our podcast. And lastly, the past couple of weeks, there have been some major updates in the Shanna Gardner case that we have been following very closely. So on February 16th, so for a backstory for all those new to the case, or if you need a fresh reminder, on February 16th, 2022, 33-year-old Microsoft executive and a father of four, Jared Bridegan, was murdered in Jacksonville, Florida. He was on his way home after dropping his 10-year-old twins off with their mother, Shanna. And a side note, Shanna, his ex-wife, is an heiress to a wealthy Mormon family's MLM crafting company. This is true. The crafting company called Stampin' Up. So as Jared was driving home with his 2-year-old daughter, Bexley, in the car from his new marriage, he noticed a tire in the road. And when he stepped out of his car to move the tire, he was quickly gunned down in front of his little 2-year-old. The investigation into his murder began, and fingers immediately were pointed at Shanna due to Jared and Shanna's extremely intense, years-long custody battle over the twins after their divorce. And Shanna absolutely denied any involvement in Jared's murder. And then after that major denial and an interview with the Florida News, she whisked her twins away to Washington State, a move on the other side of the country. Nearly 1 year, though, after Jared was killed, a man named Henry Tennant was arrested and charged with murdering Jared. Although it turns out, according to prosecutors, Henry was just the hitman, but he was also beyond, and I don't mean just the hitman, stick with me here. He was the hitman. According to prosecutors, he pulled the trigger, but he was also the previous tenant of a property owned by Shanna's new husband, Mario Fernandez. So Henry quickly took a plea deal and he gave info to police, which then led to the arrest of Mario in March of 2023, followed by Shanna in August of 2023. Shanna and Mario are both currently in jail awaiting trial. So I'm getting to our update. Stick with me here. On the day of Shanna's arrest back in 2023, Shelley Gardner, Shanna's mom, quickly secured custody of the twins by making sure she was in town and waiting outside of Shanna's Washington State house when Shanna was arrested. Shelley has allegedly, for over a year, refused to let the Bridegan family see the twins. Shanna's mom, Shelley Gardner, the matriarch to this large, again, Mormon family and a multimillionaire due to being the founder of this multi-level marketing crafting company, Stampin' Up. Well, she has been living in Shanna's Washington house that she actually purchased for Shanna. She's been living there ever since Shanna's arrest with the twins. But Jared's parents, they also want guardianship of the children, and rightfully so, in my opinion. They want to be able to see Jared's children, their grandchildren, after losing their son to murder. It's heartbreaking that this hasn't happened, which makes it seem as if Shanna Gardner's alleged motive to murder is honestly being honored, right? Doesn't that seem like what it is? Like, if the motive, according to prosecutors, is a custody battle, then it's almost like her motive for murder is being honored and carried out by her wealthy parents. Well, here's the latest. Okay, so now we're coming to this major update. It looks as if both sides recently came to an agreement, and that agreement means that Shanna and Jared's twins will continue to stay in Washington with Shanna's mother, where they were relocated after Jared's death, but the Bridegans will also allegedly get some visitation now. An alleged joint statement was released last week that reads, and I'm going to quote this here, "As the grandparents of Liam and Abigail Bridegan, we, the Bridegans and Gardners, have used a cooperative approach to foster an environment that prioritizes the children's needs, even in the face of challenging circumstances. That spirit of cooperation and collaboration led the parties to resolve the guardianship matter without the need for a trial. For both sets of grandparents, the proceedings were never about winning or losing, but about ensuring that the children's well-being remains paramount. Both parties are happy with what was settled on. We urge all parties to approach this matter with sensitivity and responsibility. We are hopeful that all parties can continue to move forward constructively, prioritizing the love and care that the children deserve. We will not be making any further comments publicly regarding this matter, and kindly request that all respect the privacy that a matter involving minor children justifies," end quote. Well, after this settlement or agreement was announced by the Gardners, it didn't end there. Kirsten Bridegan, that's Jared's widow, the stepmom to these two twins, and the mother to Jared's two youngest children, Bexley and London. She posted her own statement on her Instagram account, Justice for Jared B., and it reads, quote, "My heart has been heavier than usual this past week. This isn't what Jared would have wanted, and this isn't what I want, but some things are out of my control, ability to influence or correct. What I will say is thank you. Thank you to everyone that has shown support in the battle for Jared's oldest children through comments, prayers, donations to his parents, etc. I am continually in awe of the goodness that has risen to meet the evil we have faced every step of the way since Jared's murder in 2022. As the article states, Jared's oldest children will remain in the custody of Sterling and Shelley Gardner. It also says a confidential agreement was reached between the Breitigans and Gardners, and a joint statement will be coming. I have no involvement or support for that. Let's hope and pray justice is served in the criminal case, since it definitely wasn't served in this one. I will never stop fighting for him and for our family that was ripped apart by the evil and hatred of others," end quote. And honestly, to give my opinion, I'm proud of Kirsten for speaking out, especially if the Breitigans can't speak out now because they are gagged due to an agreement they just made that I understand that they made so that they can see their own grandkids. Because this is exactly what this smells like to me, that the Gardners are using the Breitigans' desire to see their grandkids as leverage to keep the Breitigans quiet during this heartbreaking time. And I find that heartbreaking. Kirsten has also said on her social media account that when she spoke to the Gardners in court in Florida and requested to see her stepchildren, the Gardners explained to Kirsten that that was not what Shanna wanted, and they will honor Shanna's wishes. And so again, in other words, the Stampin' Up! Clan is honoring an alleged murderer's motives for killing Jared. They're not stepping up to the plate and uniting siblings. They are making sure that this family stays divided after Jared's death. And so if you pray, pray for everyone involved. And if you send vibes or energy, do that for both the Breitigans, the entire Breitigan family. If the Breitigans are able to see their grandchildren, Jared's parents, I am so glad that they were able to come to an agreement. And I'm so grateful that Kirsten is able to speak out because she's not part of this and continue to speak her truth about what's really happening. And again, if the Breitigans are able to see their grandchildren again, what a relief. So also another update, recently there were financial documents released in that Breitigan case that showed three payments made to the hitman, Henry Tenen, on behalf of First Choice Home Rentals LLC, which is a company that is co-owned by Shanna and Mario. These payments, which were all made after Jared's murder, totaled 10 grand. The first check was for 2,000 on March 28th, which they said was for landscaping and clearing. Okay, 2,000 even. The second check was written on the same day for $3,000. And in the memo on the check, it says it was for keeping up with the roof. And then the third check on April 4th was for $5,000. And the memo was, quote, "for Kickstarter. Good luck," end quote. Shanna and Mario were back in court last Thursday for a hearing, and they are expected to be back in court on January 6th, 2025 for another hearing. Currently, the trial is scheduled for October 20th, 2025, and the prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in both Shanna and Mario's cases. However, Shanna's defense, which includes the infamous Casey Anthony lawyer Jose Baez, has filed six motions to block the death penalty. Now, you can also thank Stampin' Up! For financing the most expensive defense attorney in the country. According to the local Florida station, News4Jax, quote, "Shanna's defense is trying to prevent the state from using the word recommendation to describe the jury's role in the case if it reaches the penalty phase. Attorneys argue it misleads jurors," end quote. Another one of the things they are arguing about is a law that recently changed in Florida. And this is interesting, and it does affect the case. As it stands now, when the death penalty is sought, only 8 of the 12 jurors have to agree with the death penalty. And it used to be that all of them had to agree on the death penalty. And Shanna's team is saying that the old law should still be in effect for this case, for Shanna's case, because the new law came into effect after Jared was murdered. The motions have yet to be ruled on, so we are awaiting the judge's decision. That's it for this week. I am on my way to Delphi in just a couple of hours. I will see you at Richard Allen's sentencing, so stay tuned for all updated information. Hit subscribe and check out our additional Patreon exclusive episodes on, you guessed it, Patreon, patreon.com/hiddentruecrime. And if you like these headlines, let me know by hitting like or in comments. It's something I would love to do more of in the future. And by future, I mean 2025. And so we can keep up on the many cases Hidden True Crime continues to cover with these sort of weekly updates. Thank you for watching. Thank you for subscribing. And thank you for all of those that hung out with us in 2024.
I just got into Delphi, Indiana on a red-eye flight. I'm exhausted. There's already a line outside the courthouse. I'm trying to get to Richard Allen's sentencing. You can hear the hearing behind me because I need sleep. Like I said, we're going to all be taking shifts at this line in front of the courthouse for Richard Allen's sentencing. And I am just glad that I brought Dream. Thank you again. They were a sponsor for the trial and helped us to travel to be there at the trial. And I am grateful to have them again because I'm actually, honestly, like, I need sleep. I've got a crash. So I'm making it now. And so I was like, wait, show them. This is exactly what I'm doing. So packed, came, and this is the very, very first thing I'm doing. Now that I arrived, I've got to get like a few hours of just really solid REM. Like I'm looking for some REM, not just like a little power nap. So I got my Dream out. And again, it even has the sleep stages back here. I'm looking for sleep stage number 3. Oh no, number 4? I don't know, they tell you. Anyway, this helps not just with sleep, but with transition and memory. And then you get into the deep sleep, and then it tells you all of the amazing things that are in it. This actually is sugar-free, dairy-free, gluten-free, vegan, and then it has mushrooms and things that actually help you think better once you wake up, because I certainly need to be able to think while I'm here, because there were certainly some days during the trial that I wasn't thinking. That was a problem. So I do. I will be able to go to bed for a few hours and wake up refreshed and ready to go. Well, maybe I'll take a cup of coffee. I might need a cup of coffee. But after that, I think I'll be ready to go. And so stick with us too, by the way. I am in Delphi, and I will be bringing you the very latest. I completely forgot to mention, I just had my roommate, I was like, turn it back on, because I have to tell you that Dream actually sent me this new holiday flavor, white chocolate peppermint flavored, and I'm going to be very, very honest now because I have recommended other flavors. By far, Dream, good job, because this is by far the most favorite, is that a thing, a favoritist flavor I have ever had. Bring this all year, okay, please, because this is amazing. I want to live off this stuff. White chocolate peppermint. It is a holiday flavor though, so if you're thinking about getting it, grab this while you can. It is so good. So thank you, Beam, for doing this flavor. Right, we're not food photographers. It's amazing.